Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Radio Free Nintendo, episode 228. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, James Jones.
As always.
John Lindemann.
Hello, ladies.
Jesus.
Who's he kidding?
And Greg Leahy.
J-E-T-S. Jets, Jets, Jets. Fuck off, Belichick.
Oh, beautiful.
All right, well, that's your NFL talk for this week. In the world of Nintendo, actually, we're going to kick off with a little bit of news analysis of the 3DS. Now, I just want to let our listeners know that if you want the really in-depth, very comprehensive look at everything that happened with the 3DS this past week, you should go listen to the newscast, because I'm sure they'll spend a lot more time on it than we are. And, of course, they've got Neil Ronahan, who was actually at the event in New York. So he's got hands-on impressions and, you know, a direct account of everything that went down there. We're just going to do it really quickly, just because I think our listeners might want to know what we think about some of this stuff. And, of course, we want to know what you think as well. You can shoot us an email. But first off, on Wednesday, January, what was it, the 19th? The 19th. Nintendo had, you know, the big 3DS press conference slash game demo event simultaneously in New York City and Amsterdam, despite the difference of several hours of time zones. They hit it simultaneously. It sounds like the New York event was run much better, was a lot tighter. I know the press conference ended sooner and the game demos seemed to be less chaotic.
Well, the New York event was all run by PR people, whereas the European event had a lot more developer and publisher interaction.
Okay, well, I mean, maybe that was better then if you wanted to do interviews and roundtables. Mm-hmm. We do still have quite a bit of content going up, and you can, you know, if you missed our coverage, which was spectacular, if I may say so, then you should definitely go check that out. It's all still up at the website, and if you go to the front page, you can follow the TSIs. Well, actually, no one knows what that is. You can follow the images.
Top site images.
No, if you go to the site, you can follow the images up front.
Click on the big pictures.
I was on staff 2 years before I figured out what that meant.
it's top story image, but
fuck.
Regardless, all the content is
4
up
years.
There.
Mind blown right there.
Be sure to go check out all the in-depth coverage. We're just going to do a little quick overview here. First up, of course, the price, date, and release colors were announced for both the United States and Europe. Curiously, it seemed like, you know, normally they refer to North America or even the Americas as a single unit. And in this case, it seemed like all the announcements out of New York were very specific to the United States. And the last time I checked, there still wasn't even a price set for Canada, much less Mexico.
Nope.
Or South America. So I don't know exactly what's going on there. But in the U.S., the system is launching at $250, as we more or less expected. And it's coming on March 27th.
Yes.
So, $250. I mean, this seems like pretty much what we all expected, right?
Yeah.
Certainly didn't expect him to go lower at this point.
I didn't either.
Yeah, I mean, I was maybe looking for $200, but that was probably wishful thinking on my part.
You could keep looking, John.
When we were talking about it as a hypothetical device before the whole 3D without glasses, before it started to take shape, and certainly before the overwhelmingly positive reaction at last year's E3,
that's right.
You might have thought they might try and say under that psychological point of $199.
Yeah.
But since that time, I think most of us were expecting it to be $250 at a minimum in America, remembering, of course, that, you know, the Japanese price of 25,000 yen works out to about $300 now.
Yeah,
right.
So certainly could have gone higher, but I think they're respecting the competitiveness of the American marketplace by at least keeping it at $250.
We are our own worst enemies when it comes to pricing handhelds, apparently. We've just been like, man, this sucks.
Yeah, 3DS blows, man.
$200. Well, it makes me wonder what they think Sony is going to come out with the PSP 2.
I guess, I mean, James, I would think, would say they don't care, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they don't really, but Sony is the only one that's going to try to compete with them. So they're not doing it in a vacuum, is what I'm saying.
Well, I think in Japan it might be more of a concern. And, you know, as
very
we know,
true.
They are more influenced by Japan than perhaps they should be in some ways when you think of global proportionality. But,
yeah.
I mean, what Nintendo always says is they're competing with everything. They're competing with riding your bike for fun. They're competing with reading.
Fishing.
And, you know, everything. So, you know, from that point of view, I think they're not overly concerned about what Sony's up to, especially given how piffling their PSP business is in the Western markets anyway. But I suppose in many ways, I would say, looking at it more interestingly, in contrast to, you know, what Apple is doing to some extent, I think the most prominent thing with that is that, you know, some would say that you've had the DS software sales have been put under pressure by, you know, the fact that you could get a lot of cheap gaming content on the iOS platforms. And Nintendo's response to that has been to release a system where they feel like they could charge more for the games, not less. So they really go for a different model. And how viable that's going to be in the longer term is going to be very intriguing to me.
Well, they would also bring up the fact that with a cell phone, you would have to, maybe not with the iPod Touch, but, you know, you have the subscription fee.
Oh, there's a great array of differences, I know.
And the games aren't as good, etc. But I think the main reason that Nintendo can charge this for technology that is maybe, I mean, in terms of computing power, it's about as impressive as the PSP was 5 years ago. And I think the reason they can get away with charging this is the 3D screen. And I don't know how much that thing costs, but in terms of the realities of the marketplace, they can say, look, we've got the 3D screen. Nobody else has this. We can pretty much charge whatever we want, whatever we think's a good price. And we don't have to worry about the PSP 2 because we know they're not going to have a 3D screen.
I mean, they basically said that, their press event. I mean, he opened with the phrase, it's a market of one.
That's exactly how they look at it. And to some extent, they're right, but they can't say that and then also say they're competing with books and riding your bike and going to squash sports. You can't have it both ways.
I can tell them that beer is a lot cheaper than the Nintendo 3DS.
It achieves a similar effect.
You don't drink with Carl Castaneda, do you?
But to say because I've been on trips where we spent more than that in beer. I would say, though, that with respect to competition, the PSP2 is not coming out soon. I mean, it could be the end of the year, but it's not coming out in the next 4 or 5 months. They have the ability to hold at this price and even drop it before the PSP2 comes out.
Which, yeah, I don't think they're going to do that.
Not at 250. If they'd gone higher, if they'd gone for 300, maybe that could have happened.
But the thing is, the PSP2, from everything we're you know, by the time this goes up even, we might even know more about it, but certainly sometime next week, we should be hearing more about the PSP2. But from all the rumors about it, I don't see how Sony's going to sell that for under 300 if it's as powerful as the PS3.
Yeah.
I think they'll be taking a big risk to even sell it at the same price as 3DS, and they're certainly not going to undercut 3DS. So I think that's part of why Nintendo went with that price point, is they know that they're not going to be undersold. Now, technology-wise, the 3DS may not be as sexy as whatever the PSP2 looks like, but it has 3D, and Sony probably can't access that technology quite yet, at least until next year. So I don't think they're all that concerned about it. Now, maybe they're not looking ahead 3-4 years as they should be, but by then there'll be a new version of the 3DS that they can tweak however they want to keep up with whatever's going on in the market at the time.
Well, I think part of the issue was, if the thing really is as powerful as the PS3, why? Because, I mean, the screen, to get the detail on the screen would have to be huge.
Yeah.
Or the screen would have to have a really obscene resolution.
But, I mean, even if it did, the dots would be so small that it'd be hard for the eyes to perceive.
I disagree. I mean, you can tell the difference between an iPhone 3G and an iPhone 4.
Well, it would be more than that, though.
I think PSP2 will probably be marketed as the HD handheld, which, you know, won't be literally true, but you know, they can certainly market it that way if they feel like it. And, you know, I think that's probably what they're going for, but I don't know how much pixel resolution they can squeeze in there that will be appreciable visually.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be proportion in terms of cost is the big thing, you know. I mean, how much is it really going to impress people additionally relative to the marginal cost of having the screen be that good? I struggle to see it adding up. And then the games. You know, we are in this situation now where we're going to be talking about what looks like $40 games for 3DS in America and stuff. I mean, how much would a PS3 level development cost on a PSP2?
We know, 60.
Well, presumably, but that's the thing. Are people willing to pay $60 for portable games? As I said, it seems like, you know, if you look at what's happening with Apple, and so you'd think that the prevailing winds in terms of portable pricing is pulling them down, not up.
With 3DS software being more expensive than the previous generation, which is not unexpected, I feel like it's more important now for Nintendo to establish that cheaper games will be available on the download service. And you know, now that every single system ships with SD card storage that is upgradable, they really need to look at having, you know, much more flexible size limits for these games. I don't think you're going to be able to buy retail type 3DS games through the download shop. I mean, you can download the new God of War PSP game to your PSP instead of buying a disc. I don't think that's going to happen with 3DS, but I do think Nintendo needs to establish a marketplace in which consumers are willing and expectant of software that's download only that could cost up to, say, $20. And that's something that Apple doesn't really have at all. That's been a huge problem for them, and that's partially because the marketplace is so unrestricted for iPhone. And I think the way to do that is for Nintendo to launch a couple of games sort of in that $10, $15, $20 price range so that people kind of get used to the idea. And I'm not saying these are overpriced little mini games. I mean, these could be really meaty experiences with, you know, with the way the system is set up. And I think that's the way to go. And that way you have this kind of multi-tiered marketplace. And what happens when you do that is that people spend however much money they're going to spend on the retail games that are $40, and they'll spend even more money on the download games because they don't see those two things being the same. So they don't necessarily compete with each other, although, I mean, literally they do compete with each other, but in people's minds they don't. And so that way you can sell even more software and it doesn't crowd out all these smaller touch generation type games that Nintendo's been very successful with.
Well, it's going to be difficult though, because if you look so far, Nintendo's been unwilling to make sort of really active attempts to popularize their own download services. They have not come in there and said, here's a, you know, 1500 point WiiWare game starring, you know, Mario or Yoshi or, you know, something big that could really push it in that sort of direction. And, you know, some of that is probably because if you're dealing with, you know, a Nintendo product with a major Nintendo IP that's made up to their standards, even if it's the kind of game that you might think could fit well in a downloadable space, because of Nintendo's power as a brand, they could put it in a box and sell it for a lot more and make a lot more money that way. But the problem is that for other publishers releasing a similar product for them, you know, like a Konami franchise or something, they probably couldn't do that same thing. But the problem is that their downloadable forays will probably struggle to succeed if Nintendo doesn't at first popularize the platform, as it were. So that's kind of the unhappy medium that they've had so far.
I don't think the consumer will be satisfied having the choice between $40 retail games and $3 download games like they've got on DSi.
Yeah.
I'm curious if they really have a solid strategy for turning this into a core marketplace for them.
Well, it's not really a priority for them since it's not going to be even available at launch.
That is a misconception.
It won't be on your hardware at launch. That is not a misconception.
The reason they do this is so they can keep tweaking the shop right up until launch day so that they don't have to finalize it 3 months earlier once production starts, because if they flash that directly onto the hardware, then they have to finalize that stuff much earlier.
But it's not going to be online, so they're not going to have the actual store set up for the 3DS to even connect to.
Yeah, they will on launch day.
On launch day?
It's not 100% confirmed, but I will be shocked if you can't access that stuff on launch day.
That's the issue. I mean, if we don't know for sure yet that you're going to have it in your hands and then be able to just download that update straight away to have the shop going from the beginning. Now, as you said, I mean, it seems to me like the biggest thing is just, you know, you could be encouraged by this in a way, is that they want to get it right. And so they don't want to kind of commit themselves to it now when perhaps they haven't ironed out all the kinks yet. But it's a little shoddy that they aren't better prepared. I mean, I think the whole thing has got a bit of an 11th hour kind of feeling to it. You know, they are releasing right at the end of the fiscal year. They're just cramming it in so they don't have to tell the investors that they've missed their earnings forecast again.
They are, but anybody who thinks they're going to buy the 3DS and they won't be able to access the shop channel until June, I think you're way, way off. I think it's going to be there on day one.
I'll believe it when I see it. That's all I'm saying.
They haven't 100% confirmed it either way, but But certain people, Chris Kohler, are assuming that the sky is falling and that the stuff is not going to be ready at launch. And I just think he's wrong.
Yeah, all we know is it's not on the system already. Those systems right. have gone into production and it's not on there already. But, you know, you've got to go online to make these things work anyway. So that's exactly. not a big problem. As long as it's, you know, what you'd hope is that it's really clear in the system that, you know, here's where you go to activate the shop. That's it. Yep. So it's not hidden, it's not obscure, it's out in front, and they're really going to make a good go of it this time.
Make it easier than move. That's all I can do.
Speaking of making online things easier, we found out finally the truth about friend codes with 3DS, and it's that there is a friend code for every 3DS system, but it works for all your games. This is pretty much what I expected. It's a compromise between Nintendo's stance that you shouldn't have some kind of gamer tag type alias because that's too easy for people to guess or, you know, to, I don't know, whatever. but so it is a code. It's kind of like a phone number. It is a code that you give to people, but once you give it to them, not only can you play any online-enabled game with them without having any kind of game-specific friend code, there's even an indicator light on the system that lights up when one of your friends is online. So you can actually see when your friends are online and what games they are playing. This sounds really like a huge improvement over anything Nintendo's done before. Yeah. I mean, it's still not perfect, but I think it's good enough that I will actually be able to play this system online with some kind of regularity, which I certainly do not do with either DS or Wii. If the games are there that I want to play online, then you know, I will.
No, it's a big improvement. I think also the fact that you've just got the convenience of being able to, like, if you're in person with someone and you're doing, like, local wireless with two 3DSs, you could just exchange that information automatically, you know, without having to actually scribble numbers down or enter them in. So
sure.
for your friends, people you know personally, it's just going to be really easy. And then it's going to be too hard for just one code. I think a lot of people are going to be willing to send it out over forums like hours or whatever and build up a big friends list.
Exactly. And then that friends list will not be useless 2 weeks later once everybody's done playing that
yeah.
one
exactly.
game.
It's going to be persistent and yeah, it should be interesting. The key thing there is whether the games that, you know, specifically Nintendo, you know, it's because they're always going to set the standard, you know, on their systems, how aggressively they leverage these kinds of community, social interaction kind of stuff online.
Well, I think Capcom's actually bearing the flag on this one with Street Fighter.
Yeah.
It's probably the only major launch title that's going to have online gameplay.
Very robust, too, yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure Ridge Racer has been confirmed to not have online gameplay. And some of these other games might.
Oh, Ridge Racer.
Ridge Racer, yes. Dead or Alive does have online play.
Okay. Yeah, that one, I'm not sure if it's going to make launch or not. Street Fighter looks very likely.
When you put the modes of Dead or Alive and Street Fighter next to each other, you feel like, these games are a lot of stuff. Same checkboxes.
Like, well,
like
good.
If you watch the trailers, they're almost in the same order.
So the other interesting thing about the online store is called the eShop. There really seems like they're making a break from their previous online marketplaces. Yeah. And this time it's cash-based, so there's no Nintendo points. I think it's going to be more like the PlayStation store. You just pay for something in dollars or yen or pounds or euro, and it comes out of your credit card. I hope that you'll be able to store credit card information on it so you don't have to enter it every single time you buy something. But anyway, this is definitely an improvement, and I'm kind of glad that they're getting away from the sort of stored value system of Wii points and DSi points.
The funny money.
Yeah. And that eShop will contain, of course, the Virtual Console games. They're still calling it Virtual Console for handheld. I think it should be called Virtual Handheld.
Yep.
I don't understand the nomenclature there.
Because
but
they have to be consistent.
Yeah, like Virtual Console is this massive brand.
Yeah, they've really built yeah. up that brand with
it
all those
press releases.
It doesn't
have to make sense.
Do you know how many press releases they've put out, you know, all that time that have included Virtual
well,
Console games?
It's been about 200, actually. I mean, if it's one a week for 4 years.
But you have to take a lot of those out, unfortunately, for the last two.
Oh, that's true, because they don't have any Virtual Console games.
I can only hope that we'll see some Neo Geo Pocket Color games on there to match all the the Neo Geo games that come out on Virtual Console?
I think okay. That's likely. That's likely.
Yeah, I mean, Neo Geo's been most of the games in
the last 2 years.
Yeah, the last 6 months anyway. I mean,
it's like, I swear, they're just making new Neo Geo games to put on the service now.
They might be.
They're like games I haven't ever even heard of.
Who's paying $9 for this shit?
I am a little bit disappointed that there's literally no formats beyond Game Boy, Game Boy Color.
Yet, yeah.
GBA, you kind of think that's going to come later, but, you know, they haven't got any other platform holders of old portables on board, which, you know, I mean, obviously their libraries are not comparable with stuff like, you know, the Genesis.
Oh, I think Sega will definitely be on board as soon as
you would have thought so. Considering the way the Virtual Console on Wii has sputtered and ground to a near halt, you know, perhaps we might never see as vibrant support on the 3DS for old games as we did at the beginning with Wii, you know, where the people have just were not that thrilled with the results that they got on Wii and don't see it as being that lucrative and are not as interested in getting in on the ground floor. I hope that isn't a really significant problem.
Well, I think what might lead to the same thing happening is that the 3DSware, damn Nintendo and their naming conventions, it is probably not going to have a lot of stuff out of the gate.
No, certainly not.
And that might help the downloadable stuff be more focused on old games.
Including DSiWare. I mean, that will be available as well. And that stuff will probably continue to trickle out.
Now, to John's point, though, they could do the entire Neo Geo Pocket Color in about a week.
There aren't many games on it.
Game Gear.
I'd love to get some WonderSwan stuff on there, like import games.
How about just the GBA?
Well, yeah.
Does it seem bizarre that they said, no, we're going to hold off on that?
I mean, it may be the case that they feel like they've learned some things, or they think they've learned some things from the Wii Virtual Console experience, that they think maybe it would be better into maximizing revenue to actually phase it in almost in a sort of mini generational cycle, that you'll get more sales out of Game Boy Color games if you don't have them alongside GBA games early on.
Right.
I think that's true.
Between the Color and the GBA was really massive.
Yeah.
Yes, precisely. So, I mean, it may be that this is part of the new model. You know, and in fact, it does suggest, in a way, that they might even trickle things out even more painfully than before.
One game per month.
And to be clear, I don't just mean graphically massive. I mean the development of gameplay between the average Game Boy Color game and the average GBA game.
Well, they had different numbers of buttons and, you know, there's a lot of differences.
They were more full-featured games, too. I mean, if you go back, the majority of the Game Boy Color games are really kind of throwaways.
They are launching with Link's Awakening DX, though.
Yes, which makes me very happy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's been a long time since I played that game, so yeah. And I've actually never played the DX version.
Really?
So I'm really looking forward.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good.
All right, well, let's move on. Before we wrap up this 3DS talk, I did want to kind of ask if you have any questions that are still unanswered, obviously in terms of the timing of the shop and the browser and everything being launched. I guess that's the big one, but are there any other questions that you still feel are unanswered after all these different events?
I'm not so much curious about this as I am just somewhat interested in what they've got in mind for this whole launch window thing they've developed.
Oh, do you mean how big is that?
The launch window is huge. It's like
in the European press conference I caught. I didn't see all the way through. It happened before I came back that day and stuff. But from what I've seen, I think in the European event they said it was from March till the end of June, so it's a 3 month period.
Yes, which is a lot of time.
Yeah, and they said I think 30 games in that span.
Yeah, I'm not really all that concerned about.
Well, I'm just curious where they're sticking stuff in this window. You know,
I think they'll end up being around 10 launch games in each region. You know, the selection might be slightly different, and the rest of it will come out a little later.
I understand that they can't, you know, say, okay, well, these are the games we're going to launch with, because it's not always clear. But
yeah, they still haven't committed to which ones are actually going to be on March 25th/7th, depending on where you are in the Western world.
It was just very weird how they handled it.
All right, well, my last question for the group here, are we down for buying this thing at launch?
Yeah, it was funny. I was bitching about it last night to a friend of mine, and we're both going to buy it at launch.
Nice.
Yeah.
I was like, well, this isn't going to be there at launch, blah, blah, blah. You buying it? Yup.
James, you're set.
Yeah, I'm in.
I mean, I already have mine pre-ordered.
Yeah, I bought one on Amazon, so it'd probably be the day after launch when I get it, since it's launching on Sunday.
Now, Greg, what are you going to do, like, because the prices are set by retailers over in Europe, right?
Yeah, so it's not one price. You know, there are slight disparities. Certain online retailers got it for like $220 versus $230, which is right around where I got my PS3 for in September 2009, to put it in the context. I mean, as it said last week, I think it was, yeah, $200 was the absolute minimum for me. So the prices would surprise me. You consider what we talked about last week in terms of currency fluctuations, VAT, they've corrected for that. And that's the price we've got now. How much that's going to impact on, you know, people's budgets are still people's budgets.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Well, that's going to play out on a macro scale. For me, I'm not decided yet. I mean, the most compelling reason that I could come up with for getting one at launch is that it might be difficult to get one after launch.
Yeah.
Because if it's really popular, then you might find if you don't get in now, you could go for, as it happened with the Wii, where you get like months where you can't find one in stores and people are buying them on eBay for silly prices. And, you get these sites set up to give you instant updates when Amazon's got some in. And, if that happens. And, it gets to June. I've got my birthdays in June, or, maybe it gets a bit later than that. Some of the games that I'm more interested in start rolling in, or they've accumulated, great libraries of virtual console stuff or 3DSware that I'm interested in, whatever it would be. You might regret not getting in on the ground floor. So that's really what I'm wrestling with right now. I mean, I could easily wait until my birthday, for instance, just on the basis of the games that are coming out in that launch window from March to June, because it's nothing that I'm that desperate to play.
Right. The question is, would you still be able to at that point?
Yeah, so it really is a practical matter at this point.
Does it turn into a Wii situation, essentially?
Rather than a content thing. I haven't made my mind up yet. I suppose I'd better get on with it.
I would think that we're not likely to have another Wii situation, because that was just moronic.
Yeah, I think at the most, maybe things will sell out generally at launch, and then you might have like a 2-week gap where they get more in. And then
It depends. Yeah. We're hearing the numbers, 4 million they're going to have for that global month launch that they're having, end of February in Japan and then end of March for Europe and America. I think they're going to have 4 million units to spread around in that period.
Right.
How long does that last? How much more have they got coming down after that? I mean, that production is going to be a big thing. You think they'd be better prepared than they've been in the past, because 3DS got way better press before the event than Wii and DS, and obviously having already had those successes, they think they could gonna do it again. So you'd think they'd be better prepared if we wouldn't get a shortage, but you can't rule it out the way these things have gone.
I'm really excited for E3 in terms of finding out what kind of big holiday titles they've got planned for 3DS. What's the kind of, I don't know if it's second generation, but like the 1.5 generation of software, the non-launch stuff that's a little bit more mature, that they've had more time to keep in the oven and really flesh it out. Especially the first party stuff, because I think the initial first party stuff isn't that exciting.
There isn't much of it.
I am certainly considering Pilot Wings, but Nintendogs, no thank you. I've been fooled. Can't fool me again.
This has got cats. It's got cats that apparently don't care what you tell them to do, because they're cats. That's the best part. It's, all right, we have these virtual pets, but they don't give a shit about you.
Yeah, and Ocarina doesn't interest me that much. Star Fox, I'm still waiting to see what they're really changing in that game, because if it's just a pretty straight port, sorry, I've got it on Wii.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like, as I said before, the save feature would be nice, because N64 didn't have it, and the Virtual Console version doesn't have a suspend feature because it's an N64 game. So if you've got a save and maybe online leaderboards for the high score stuff, it doesn't have to be a lot. Just give me something.
All right, so James, John, and I are all we're all committed at this point. Greg is still deciding, but you need to choose soon, right? Because if the launch demand is...
But, you know, I mean, certainly I'd be, you know, the games are not overwhelming by any means. Yeah. I mean, it's always assuming that you would have everything digital up early, you know, like the DSiWare games that I'm interested in, stuff like Shantae, and, you know, maybe some early virtual console offerings like the Link's Awakening DX. Those would easily be the most excited I'd be to play on 3DS rather than Steel Diver or Pilot Wings. Or...
Well, I will say, though, that the launch lineup is much better than the Ping Pal level of suckiness of the DS launch lineup.
You bite your tongue.
DS had a fucking terrible launch lineup.
It was fucking terrible. That is the only way it can be described.
Yeah, I think the
right,
issue
Johnny.
Here is that, yeah, why some people, including myself, might feel a little bit underwhelmed by it or at the end of the day, is, you know, as we covered in the episode 200, we was looking back at the DS. The DS was obviously rushed because of the issues with the PSP coming out. You know, they wanted to cut it off the pass to get something out there for a lower price.
It was
price.
A prototype. I mean, they literally shipped a prototype.
Yeah, and then we got the kind of the real deal a bit later with the light, you might argue.
Yep.
But with this, you know, the DS had such great longevity in a number of ways that you think the dominance in the portable arena was so unchallenged that you think they, when they did have a system ready to go, they'd have all their ducks in a row, and it would just be a much more impressive launch than it is, considering, as I said, it's very much got the look of something that's just like, get it out before the end of the fiscal year.
Mm-hmm.
Come hell or high water, whatever we got, it's going, and that's it.
Yep.
All right, well, our 3DS talk is going to wrap up now. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we've got some new business for you and listener mail. Welcome back to Radio Free Nintendo. I've got out the wine, so you know what time it is.
Oh, yeah.
New business.
That's not what I had in mind.
I got a little too excited there.
Greg is up first with a new DS game.
Yeah, so I got Ghost Trick on European launch day, which was just a matter of days after the American launch day, which is always nice, especially given this is a very text-heavy game. There's a lot of reading in this, so they have a nice job on getting the localization done for the rest of Europe that I... I'm not exposed to, obviously. I don't know whether the quality of the work was any good for the French and the Italians, etc. But yeah, I played that through to completion in the past week and enjoyed it very thoroughly. It's not the kind of experience I've played a whole lot of. For instance, I haven't played the Ace Attorney games at all, not one of them. So I've kind of felt like this would be an interesting testing ground for whether I might like to go back and get any of those. Because the fact that obviously it's similar in the kind of narrative that it is, this sort of wacky crime related kind of storylines, is obviously a big similarity. But the fact that it has the very unique graphic style that it does with the rotoscope animation that I've, from the first time they showed it back, I think it was TGS 09, it was very eye catching then. And the environmental puzzle solving appealed to me a lot. I've been a big fan of Zakawiki, you know, Capcom's other sort of adventure puzzle game.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
It seemed really promising to me from that angle. So I thought, if I then enjoy the story, then maybe I can sort of graduate onto some of the Ace Attorney stuff after that. And having gone through that process now, I think I would, because I think the story was actually a big part of what I enjoyed about the game. The environmental puzzle solving was pretty satisfying, but it's not as open-ended as something like Zakawiki, or there isn't quite the same feeling like you've created a solution, which, yeah, maybe is somewhat illusory even in something like Zakawiki. You know, there's kind of really most of the time a right thing to do, but here, because it is so narrative driven and just the way they present things, a lot of the time, you know, the characters are kind of talking out what to do.
Right.
And so they'll give you pretty big hints as to how you're going to proceed. And also, when you possess objects with the main character, Sissel, there's not a lot of different things he can do with any given thing. You know, it's very limited how you can interact with each object.
But aren't there aren't there a number of red herring type objects with actions that you would never actually use in a puzzle?
There will be, yeah. Especially like because you will revisit certain locations quite a few times in the game. So it might be useless in one occasion, but it'd be useful the next time, or vice versa, you know. So it's kind of cool, actually, how you could end up revisiting places you wouldn't think you would revisit, and then you end up seeing different parts of the room and different objects and use them again. So, yeah, I mean, that part of it, I think some of the time, it's just fun to see how these scenarios where you kind of go back in time, saving a person's life after finding their corpse, seeing how those scenarios just play out is fun, let alone sort of your part of actually solving that puzzle that the scenario constitutes. So it is really uniquely kind of satisfying. It's got a great, I think the pacing's good, even though it's a lot of reading. Yeah, that is a problem sometimes, you know, it's easy to kind of get bogged down, but it maintains a sense of momentum because the events of the story are all taking place over one night. So it just kind of keeps driving through. You know, there's not going to be any kind of big lulls in the action or whatever, but it still goes on for a decent amount of time. I didn't keep an hour count. I think you said about 12.
That's what my guess was, yeah.
Yeah, I that sounds about consistent with what I probably played. And for that time, you know, I imagine I played it very much more piecemeal and gradually than James did for the purposes of a review, obviously. But it definitely is something that keeps you coming back to it. You want to see how it resolves, because the story is, it's wacky and it's convoluted and it's silly. The big mystery really is just your own identity and your, what's happened to you, and there's constantly reasons for why. It's like, oh, you think you're gonna find something out, no, actually that person can't remember that bit, or you know, there's always another reason why you can't find out about yourself. But even so, it gives you enough to keep going, and it's just like mysteries within mysteries within mysteries, and it is full of character. I mean, the way they use the animation style they've got, the rotoscoped animation, is very cool and quite sort of ostentatious, you know. I mean, one character's like this austere civil servant or something, maybe the police commissioner. Even he is like, kicks his shoes off under the table, is like twiddling his toes, and yeah, everyone's doing little things, it's showing off, but it does bring the events to life.
There are whole characters that seemingly exist just to show off that technology. I mean, there's a character who, from a standpoint of the game, has no value at all. He does nothing. At no point does he advance the plot, but he dances around like a crazy person. So he might actually be a crazy person. I mean, it's just there to say, look what we can do.
But on the other hand, it does, you know, kind of enhance some of the more main characters, like the Inspector Cabanela, I guess it would be pronounced. Yeah. You know, like he sort of dances a lot as well, actually.
Yeah.
But it does convey his personality, and that is crucial to the story. That isn't just like extraneous, like show off stuff. He is actually a really big part of, and his attitude is a big part of the events as they go on, and is conveyed with this animation style in a way that it wouldn't be if it was just static character portraits that were conveying the characters.
Well, I'm very tempted by Ghost Trick. I don't know that I will like it as much as you guys, but I definitely am curious to try it, and I think I'll enjoy it enough to satisfy a purchase. It's just that I don't play these games nearly as fast as either of you two. I'm still crawling through Layton, and we checked earlier, and I've now played Layton in the Unwound Future for like 13 and a half hours, and I'm apparently about two-thirds of the way through the game, whereas James actually beat it in that amount of time.
Yes.
So I don't know. I do sometimes will set it down and walk away for a minute to go do something else, but maybe I'm just more meticulous about how I play it. I don't know.
How would you say the game would appeal to like a Phoenix Wright fan?
They would wet themselves over this game, John.
I mean, I can imagine not everyone would be a fan of this kind of story. If you're a Phoenix Wright fan, I guess that is, it's in that wheelhouse, so you know where you stand. But like, it's because it's kind of convoluted and it's kind of compound craziness. Maybe that would be too much nonsense, maybe, for some people, but I found it fun from that point of view. And the other thing, I guess the big knock that I've read in some, I mean, it's generally got really good reviews, including James, obviously, but the biggest knock I've kind of read against it, some of the less favourable ones, is just that it could be frustrating, you know, repeating stuff a lot. And, you know, like sometimes, you know, it comes down to specific timing. And if you miss that, then you've got to restart a puzzle. Now, for me, it wasn't a problem, but I am someone who has enjoyed some of Capcom's other games featuring the word ghost in the title. So, you know, I'm not, I was never worried about that being a problem for me.
I think if you take that timing stuff out, you kind of make it impossible to lose. I mean,
I see, it's very guided, isn't it? I mean, yeah. I really didn't have a lot of times where it's like, oh God, I don't know what to do. I'm clicking this and that, and I'm doing nothing. I'm accomplishing nothing. I mean, you know, you will test things out. Right. And you might notice, you know, oh, well, I've done that in the wrong order, obviously, so let's rewind time to do it again. So there's some repetition there. But generally, it wasn't that irksome to me. But again, like I said, I mean, what's it going to take? What has it got to take to make me throw my hands up and say no more? I mean,
apparently it can't be done. The question is, can anyone design a game that Greg will just give up on because it's too frustrating?
Monster Hunter?
Monster Hunter? Well, yeah.
I might go back to it.
But my prediction actually is that I will end up picking up Ghost Trick on the way to PAX East. We'll talk about that later.
It would be a a good airplane game.
Yeah, I think so.
I will often buy. I don't play that many portable games around the house, so I will often end up picking up some DS game I've been meaning to play when I go on a trip, because that's typically when I play the most DS is when I'm traveling. All right, well, we'll move on, and I'm gonna go next. I've actually got a couple of games that I pretty much wrapped up last week, so I wanted to go over them quickly, even though I've talked about them before. First up is Donkey Kong Country Returns. I hate to bring this up again, but I did beat the game last week. I beat the final boss, which I thought was one of the better designed bosses in the game, but damn, it's way too reminiscent of bosses from other Nintendo games, to the point where it felt kind of like a ripoff, you know?
It's like, yeah, just mix in, like, Andross with something else. I mean,
okay, so look, I'm not spoiling how, I mean, you know you're fighting this tiki thing.
Yes.
Not that there's that much story to it. So you know you're going to be fighting this giant tiki thing at the end. But you start off fighting its giant floating hands, which I've already seen done in Super Mario 64 and multiple Smash Brothers games.
What I love about it, though, is it has the flashing red spot just like Andross.
Andross, yes.
No, that happened in Mario 2, didn't it?
Where you fought in the pyramid, and they had eyes in the hands.
The eyes. Okay, that's what it was.
Bit like Pan's Labyrinth, I suppose.
There's a Zelda boss in Twilight Princess just like this, too.
And, of course, Kirby Super Deluxe, that's got basically like proto Master Hand. Like, that's where Master Hand and Crazy Hand come from, is from that game. So you can take it back to that as well.
It's just too many damn Nintendo games with hands as bosses. It just, I don't find it to be that interesting. And even the moves that it's doing in Donkey Kong are pretty much straight out of Smash Brothers. I mean, you could look at that as a tribute, but I felt like it was just really obvious and
uninspired.
Yeah, uninspired. Exactly.
No more hands in Nintendo games. Everybody's like Kirby now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my overall opinion on Donkey Kong, it's a game that I like, but I don't like as much as most other people, and it's not a game that I like as much as I wanted to, because I was excited to play it, and it never had that magical moment for me where I felt like I was playing it correctly.
Yeah, it's a game I like but don't love, and I wanted to love.
Yeah, for me too. I was lucky to have dinner with TYP a couple nights ago. He was traveling in Colorado for business, and unfortunately, the schedule didn't allow for him to come do the show with me tonight, because I would have loved to do that. But we were talking about Donkey Kong and a bunch of other games, and I told him that, for me, Donkey Kong Country Returns felt like a game where the abilities of the character of Donkey Kong never completely synced up with the way the levels are designed. I always felt like when I made a jump, Donkey Kong just barely made it, and in fact, in a lot of cases, he didn't make it, and I fell down and died. And that's very, very annoying for me. And, you know, maybe originally it was because I was playing with the remote only, and I wasn't holding down the run button since it's undocumented. And maybe in other cases, it's because I should have rolled, but I didn't. But the gap was small enough that I didn't think I needed to roll. And then there are a lot of cases where I needed to bounce off of an enemy. And I feel like the timing for that extra bounce off the top of an enemy is really tricky. And I never felt like I was doing it consistently, even though I always felt like I was doing it correctly. So it certainly doesn't break the game, but it keeps it from having that really smooth, excellent 2D platformer feel that I want out of a game like this. And even towards the end of the game, there were a lot of moments where I felt like if you did that right the first time, it would have been purely by luck. And this has been a problem really in all of the Donkey Kong Country games, back to the the original series on Super Nintendo. But there are places where it's not even so much finding secrets, but even just to finish a level in Returns, towards the end, there are parts of those levels where I feel like they don't give you enough visual clues to prepare for what you need to do in time. And so there were a lot of places where I died the first couple times because it wasn't really clear what I needed to do, and I had very little time to react to it. And then there were a couple times where I actually got through it, but I felt like I got through it because I was lucky and not because I played the game correctly. It's just not the feeling that I want to get out of a 2D platformer. I mean, I feel like it's very competently made, but it's not made with the kind of expertise that you get out of like a Nintendo EAD platformer. So I wouldn't be opposed to Retro Studios doing another 2D platformer, but I would want them to have more time to polish it and to work with Nintendo to really make it feel like a Nintendo platformer. And that's ultimately the problem, is that I never felt like it lived up to that standard for me.
Well, I still think if you didn't have this absurd ambiguity about the control schemes, would have helped. You know, I mean, it's the kind of thing that didn't end up affecting me at all, but I still think it's ridiculous, just that, you know, you can have this situation where maybe someone will, you know, try one, try the other, and not really develop, you know, the sort of maximum affinity, you know, so that it will click with them. Because that's really what it says, it just didn't click with you really all the way.
Right,
ever.
It never clicked, and I kept waiting for it to. I kept thinking, man, if I get to the factory level that everybody's talking about, that's when it's really going to click. And it doesn't, because it's not about the different themed worlds or the different kinds of levels inside. It comes down to the basic mechanics. It comes down to how fast Donkey Kong runs, how high he jumps, how quickly he falls, and how far apart the platforms are spaced. And it's really rudimentary stuff. And, you know, and part of it comes down to personal taste.
Yeah.
It just didn't quite get to where I like my 2D platformers to be. For a lot of other people, it did. And I wish I could enjoy the game the way that you did, for instance, Greg, because I played the whole thing.
I liked it. I like the sense of weight, you know, slightly less graceful platform character, really. You know, I actually kind of like that for whatever. But, you know, I could deal with Little Big Planet, Ghosts and Goblins. We've established I'm quite tolerant.
You know, maybe, and maybe you might actually be getting to a bigger issue here. I think I do like more acrobatic, graceful characters in a platformer.
Yeah, and I could appreciate that in terms of, you know, stuff like one of the things I've talked about many times, like Zero Mission, you know, just how acrobatic and fast and perfect Samus is in that game compared to the other games in the series even is wonderful. But I don't find the absence of that a problem if everything feels like it's designed right around it. And for me, it did. I do think it's a bit, I know you've mentioned in emails and stuff that you probably won't go and get the secret levels, because obviously if you didn't like it that much, you're not going to be motivated to go back and get the letters right, to unlock them. But I mean, those secret levels are really good. I really enjoy fiendish stuff, but very, very good.
Yeah, see, I find the normal levels to be so frustrating already that I'm not looking for an amped up version of that.
Yeah, sure.
So another game I played is Final Fantasy 13. I know I've talked about this game a bunch of times, but I did actually get to the final boss, finally. I actually sank like nearly 10 hours into it last week. And well, we didn't talk about Normal New Business last week, so it's kind of over a two-week period, but I did spend a lot of time playing it because I was like, damn, I'm tired of this game sitting on top of my pile. I want to be done with it. And I like the game, but it is long as shit. It just feels like it never ends. And the final areas of that game really feel never-ending. I mean, I just kept thinking, oh my god, when does it stop? And it's not that I wasn't having fun, but it's not paced very well. It doesn't really feel like you're making a lot of progress. It's just kind of this doldrums towards the end of the game where you're moving forward, but the place you move into looks like the place before it. So it doesn't feel like you're making any progress. And it's not that it's less fun, but you do kind of, it would be nice to feel like you're getting closer and closer and closer. And I think it loses that sense a little bit. And then I got to the final boss and just got creamed, which I was very upset by, because I felt like I had actually been playing very conservatively. I'd been, I'd been grinding a little bit. I'd been leveling up a lot. I'd paid a lot of attention to upgrading my equipment, and I'd put a thought into how I upgraded my characters in an intelligent way so that they'd really be beefed up for this final battle. And I thought, I'm going to do pretty well on this. And I played it a couple times, and you know, I felt like I was using good strategy and I was playing it in a nimble way, but the final boss just, it has a couple of attacks that'll just kill you immediately. And when it does that, there's nothing you can do about it.
And the thing is, playing the early parts of that game, it kind of feels like you would be guided through to the end. There doesn't really seem like there's anything that you come up against that will just cream you outright, even the bosses that you fight.
Well, I think the game is challenging throughout. I mean, I think it actually does a good job of that. I mean, one of the nice things about the combat system is that because a lot of the nuts and bolts details of which ability the characters use at any given time, a lot of that stuff can be automated. I mean, you can control it manually, but you wouldn't really want to because it's so inefficient.
Yeah.
So because a lot of those details are taken care of for you and you're thinking more in overall strategy terms, and also because all of your health and magic and stuff like there is no magic, but because of all of your health and status ailments and things like that are healed between battles, and so you don't have to stock up on Phoenix downs and crap like that. Mm-hmm. It allows them to make every single battle throughout the entire game interesting and challenging in some way. I mean, they can always test you because if you die, you just retry. There's no penalty for dying.
Yeah.
So they encourage you to just go all out every single battle. So I feel like the game actually overall has a really nice difficulty curve. It's more difficult than you would expect, but in the best possible way. In other words, the battle, even the most menial battles, are almost never boring. And that's been a problem since the very first Final Fantasy game. And it's a kind of an inherent problem in Japanese RPGs. And I really commend Square Enix for finding a way to solve that in the design of their battle system. And it's part of the reason I love the battle system so much. But then I got to the end, and this was the first time where I felt like, geez, I just feel unprepared for this. I feel like my characters are not ready. And I've done a lot of optional stuff, and I've done a lot of grinding. It was really demoralizing in the sense that I didn't really want to play it anymore.
I think this is where Johnny and I really diverge, because it's like when I get really close to the end of a game, I have to beat it.
Oh, yeah.
Like if I hadn't got as close as I did with Ghosts and Goblins, I think I might have given up. But because I got that close, it's like, no, now I have to. Whereas Johnny's like, oh, I've seen the game anyway. Screw you.
Exactly. I've already done 99% of it.
You know, which is far more logical.
It's kind of like another Final Fantasy game, Four Heroes, where the final boss is an ass. Just supreme ass. But because the bosses level up with you, I may have already passed the point where he can be beaten.
It's yeah, I mean, the difference between me and Greg, I think, is I see the glass as being 1% full and he sees it as being 99% empty or something like that.
So in the case of that boss, I probably threw 10 hours at him.
That is so unappealing to me.
Well, it gets to a point where you're like, I've committed this much time anyways, I might as well go
and then you look down and you've been grinding and throwing yourself at him for 10 plus hours and you're like, this bastard is the Rock of Gibraltar.
Yeah, it's like if I quit now, all my time spent really is a waste.
But see, it's just a psychological difference. I don't think in those terms, you know. I feel like if I spend 10 hours on this guy and I still can't beat him, those 10 hours truly were a waste because I've made no progress. The sad thing is, in the case of an RPG like this, certainly one in Final Fantasy 13, I'm sort of interested in the story. It's not a great story, but it's good. And I've been happy to follow it all along. I don't skip the cutscenes. I like watching them. I like hearing what the characters have to say. But this is a case where if the story was really compelling, and I felt like everything had been building to this moment, and the game would be absolutely incomplete if I didn't beat the final boss and see the ending, then that might actually push me forward. But instead, I feel like I've already seen most of the story. It's very inevitable what's going to happen in the end. I don't really feel like there's any surprise left for me, you know? Like, I feel like I have very little to learn by beating this boss and seeing whatever happens after that.
What about the promise of 13-2?
That's right. I mean, this...
Dangling the carrot.
Well, 13-2, I'm actually really interested in because I do like this game, and I'm curious to see how they improve upon it and also iterate on it. And, you know, if you look at 10-2, they did some pretty radical stuff with that. And I haven't played 10-2 because I don't like 10 that much to begin with. I do like 13 a lot.
Dress up
games. So I am interested in 13-2, despite the horrible name. but do I feel like I need to beat 13 to understand what's going to happen in 13-2? Hardly. So right now it's a matter of motivation, you know? I mean, it might take me 5-10 more hours of gameplay in order to get over this hurdle of the final boss, and do I think that's worth it? Probably not. So I don't know if I'm going to go back to it.
Oh, you will. It'll eat away at you. You'll wake up screaming one
Who
night.
Who are you
and you'll
to
be
talk, Lindemann?
John, if I could tell you, if I could make a list of all the games I got to the final boss and just quit because it was annoying.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard quite a lot of these stories. That's why I brought it up. It's just like, I'm trying to think if I've ever left the last boss on the table.
I never have.
Yes, because you never gotten to him. You never.
John's never seen the final boss.
I play through certain titles, James.
What titles are those?
Let's see, the last game I beat, I think, was I beat Uncharted 2.
No, you beat that God of War PSP game. You told us.
I beat God of War Chains of Olympus. That guy, I didn't even realize that was the last boss. I probably would have actually.
I am available as a memory consultant, John. If you
well, I didn't know. I really didn't keep track of how far I was in the game. Also, it's not a long game either.
No. So, the last game, and I'm going to be very quick because I know I'm going to continue playing this, and I'll probably want to talk about it more in depth in the future, but I rented Borderlands from Gamefly. It's a first-person shooter RPG, basically, which actually, now that I put it in those terms, sounds really interesting to me. But before I got the game, I wasn't all that excited about playing it. I just kind of put it on there because everybody talks about it so much, and I just wanted to see what the fuss was about. And this game is really addictive and really compelling and just very, very well made. I'm really impressed by it. And the first thing I had to notice was the graphic style is cel-shaded.
Yes.
It looks actually a lot like Red Steel 2, but in HD with better art design. So I really like the presentation of it, and the gameplay is actually quite similar to Mass Effect 2. It's first person instead of third person, but the general idea is the same in that you're shooting dudes and, you know, hit points come off of them. It has this RPG pull in that, you know, there's always this question of what's my level compared to their level, and, you know, I kill guys, I get experience, I build up my character, I get new skills and things like that. So it always feels like your character's growing and becoming more powerful, and that allows the game to throw more and more interesting and more difficult enemies at you. But at the same time, it plays in a very direct, very fast-paced action format of first-person shooter, and it helps that it's a very, very good first-person shooter. Whereas, you know, Mass Effect 2, I love the RPG parts of it, I love the shooting part of it, but it's not the best third-person shooter out there. It's kind of a pretty good third-person shooter with some very good RPG elements overlaid onto it that make it more compelling and addictive. Whereas in Borderlands, I think it's actually an excellent first-person shooter, and the RPG elements make it just throw it way over the top in terms of how compelling it is to play.
So that's kind of a flip, though, because in the first Mass Effect, it was more RPG-ish.
Yeah, but in some annoying ways, actually. And that gets me to the loot, because I think whether loot finding is fun or not depends a lot on how good is the loot and how good are your tools to compare it to determine whether or not you want to pick it up, whether or not you want to throw it away. And Borderlands walks a fine line there. The first Mass Effect was horrible at loot. Horrible. Too Human is horrible at loot.
Well,
Torchlight is really good at it, actually. And that's one reason that I enjoyed playing it. And I was surprised by how much I got into that loot system. Borderlands is kind of in the middle. The loot that you get is guns, and when you find a really good gun, it's awesome because that really changes how you play the game. And that's a lot of fun. But I feel like the tools for you comparing your guns to... And there are tools in there, but they're a little bit clunky to use. And a lot of times you look at it and it has some crazy name. And it's not really clear how good it is. And I just feel like there's too many of them. There are too many shitty guns that you have to pick up and then find out later that it's not good and you have to sell it. You know, and when loot is that plentiful and that useless, then it's not really loot anymore, is it? It's just crap. It's garbage. So that's one of my least favorite parts about the game, but damn, the actual combat, the level design, and the RPG elements of building up your character are, whoa, they're really good, and the presentation's excellent. So I see what the fuss is about now, and I'm glad I played it, and it's the second game ever that I told Gamefly I want to keep it. It's
I had a buddy I used to work with who just freaking loved Borderlands. Loved it. And I was always kind of like, you know, how good could it be?
Oh, John, this is totally your game.
It
I mean,
probably
you would love
be.
This game.
Yeah.
Absolutely love it.
Yep.
So, James, please tell me what the hell is 999?
Well, so it is a short version of the full title of this game, which is 9 Hours, 9 Persons, 9 Doors, which essentially it's a visual novel slash puzzle game.
For PC?
No, it's a DS game.
Oh.
The game itself, you play as Junpei, who was apparently kidnapped, although he doesn't remember much of the details, and locked on this really old cruise liner. Or not cruise liner, like just like a liner ship, like one that used to cross the Atlantic Ocean. 4 planes. And he, along with 9 other people, have basically been locked up on this ship and told they have to escape in, I think it's 9 hours, duh.
9 hours.
Yes. or it does. It starts before the 9 hours starts, which is what got me. But oh. They have to get off the ship in 9 hours before it sinks.
So explain really quickly, what is a visual novel?
A visual novel is just that. It is a whole lot of text you read with pictures. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
So like Hotel Dusk?
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what you're dealing with. You see the characters when they're talking set on these hand-drawn backgrounds. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. A lot of the game is just them talking to each other. And then you make a series of decisions that determine what ending you get.
So it's like a choose-your-own-adventure novel illustrated.
Yeah, and you have no clue where you're going to end up, and you're almost certainly going to wind up in the bad end. That's how visual novels tend to go. You almost always end up in bad end.
Do you have experience with this genre?
I have played visual novels way back in the past.
Okay.
Like back when I had like a really old computer and all it could play were static image games. But
that reminds me of something on Scott Sharkey's website where he had a screenshot of him playing an old a visual novel type game where you enter the text and it was like Rape Tom. You don't need to use the word rape to play this game. Have consensual sex with Tom. You don't have to use the word consensual to play this game. And then it just has, I'm getting mixed messages here. Oh, Sharky, I miss you. There's a new Retronauts with him on, though.
Yes, that's true. And I think they'll probably be at PAX East. But more about that later.
So the idea is that all 9 of these characters are wearing a watch on their hand that has a number 1 through 9 on it. And they have to combine their numbers into the form digital roots, which, if you don't know what that is, it's essentially you add all the numbers together, all the digits together, and then that's the digital root. And if it's more than one digit, the result. So if you're adding 5 and 7, digital root of that, well, 5 plus 7 is 12. So then you take 1 plus 2 is 3. So 5 and 7's digital root is 3. And you use these to unlock these doors that they have to go through or they die. Because a bomb that's been implanted in them will explode. So only people who open these doors can go through them, and they all have to go through, or like I said, everyone who goes through the door dies. It's pretty macabre. And you'll usually get presented with multiple doors, and you have to say, okay, what order can I go through that everybody can go through a door? Or you get blown up like the character at the very start of the game, and they describe in relatively morbid detail what became of his body. This game is pretty unpleasant.
How strong is the puzzle solving element?
What happens,
you know,
because
I guess people might think like Trace Memory or Another Code or whatever was quite famous early in the DS's life for like using the fact that you could close the DS to solve a puzzle and like all sorts of gimmicks like that. Or the Wii version uses the Wii remote in a bunch of different ways. Like, does it have quite creative puzzles or is it a bit more run of the mill?
So usually after each door you go through, you wind up in a room, and once they deactivate the bombs after they've gone through the door, which they have to do in a certain amount of time, it's essentially, you'll find that the only way out of this set of rooms you're in is usually another locked door that's locked by some kind of puzzle.
Right.
It's a lot like a Myst puzzle, where, you know, you have to go around and look at things and try to find items to put together to solve the puzzle.
Right.
So one good example is you're in a first-class cabin. It's got 2 rooms. It's got, you know, a study. There's a lock on the door that has a stereoscopic microphone on it. So you have to go ahead and try to find a way to open it. And what you have to do is you have to play this song on the piano, but the notes for the piano aren't on it. You have to find individual parts of the song on glass plates and then lay them on top of each other. And they're hidden throughout the room. You have to solve some minor puzzles to get to some of them, like one of them's in the fireplace, so you have to find water to put out the fire.
Right.
And then when you get through, you know, you go through the whole story bit again, and then you usually have to make another door decision. And where I'm at right now, they've concluded that they're in front of a door. One character's missing, and they've basically just said, we're never going to find him. We don't have enough time. They looked for 2 hours, to be fair. And they've realized that the three doors presented to them, not everybody can go through. Somebody's going to get stuck behind.
Wow.
And your friend...
It's like Sophie's Choice.
It really is. Your friend is just screaming, I don't want to do this. This is a terrible plan. And
because he's the one that's getting left behind.
No, actually, it's another person volunteers to be left behind. It's pretty a little bit upsetting, to be honest.
So, I mean, is this whole thing written well? Because it seems like it would have to be in order for it to be satisfying.
Some of the dialogue is kind of shitty, but the plot itself is actually pretty compelling.
Right. Yeah.
Because in the case of Junpei, he wound up on this boat, and one of the first people he runs into, he recognized, or it took him a while for it to click, is actually a friend of his from elementary school. And I guess they've concluded that there's no way this could just be coincidence, that these people, whoever they are stalking them and made their picks essentially that way. So I know there's at least three endings. There's a bad ending, which is apparently described as being really, really, really bad. And there's this, I guess there's an ending that solves all the mysteries, and then there's the good end. I'm pretty sure that with two characters at least dead, I've pretty much missed the good end altogether. So I might be stuck with a bad end, which is going to be really depressing because apparently it's really bad.
There's a little fact that you're sweeping under the carpet about this game, James.
What's that?
It's developed originally by Chunsoft.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bane of James' existence from the Mystery Dungeons.
They might still be the bane of my existence if this bad end is what I get, and it's as bad as it apparently sounds like it is.
But I have to know what crazy, crazy publisher is stupid enough to release this in the U.S., a visual novel in English.
I'll give you a hint. At PAX East, they had a bunch of girls dressed as shooters from a gothic Lolita-inspired Xbox 360 shoot 'em up. They also published all your BitTrick games.
Axis. Okay.
Yeah. So they'll publish anything, apparently. So you're in good shape there.
Yeah, this just sounds beyond niche. I mean, even XSEED wouldn't touch this.
So what's weird is, I mean, there was basically no PR campaign that we could discern.
I've never heard of it before, like, today.
What was weird is the game came on my radar because, you know, a handful of sites were putting up reviews and going, whoa. So here's the thing about it. It hasn't quite gotten its hooks into me yet, but I want to see what's going to happen with this story. Because even if I get the bad end, I have a feeling that if I'm not traumatized, because it apparently is quite bad, that I'll go back and play through the game much more quickly, because you can fast forward through all the dialogue, to try to find the good end. I'm playing it without a guide, so I don't know. A lot of these visual novels, to get the good ends, you have to use a guide, essentially, or just experiment. And because there's so many branching paths, it's really hard to find the one that leads to the good end. And you could fuck yourself with just one bad choice. And I made... Yeah.
I'm just imagining the text prompt for that choice.
fuck yourself.
Don't fuck yourself.
Oh, so hard.
No, actually, there's an on-screen keyboard that you use the touchscreen to type in, fuck myself.
It's not going to give you a heads up that you're about to do something disastrous.
I'm getting mixed messages here.
Oh, jeez.
Call back.
It might have been a Wired review where they basically said, this game gets an M rating and never really shows you any of the gore.
So it's the themes of that dark.
Just how they describe things. The fact that, I mean, I know on my current playthrough, I just basically gave someone a death sentence.
Well, I mean, that alone is actually really interesting now that you say that, because how many M-rated games are there on DS? Like, four?
Probably. Is Dementium M-rated?
Well, yeah, both of the Dementiums are M-rated, and then I think GTA Chinatown, and that's about it. So this might be number four.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting mental experiment.
Okay, well, that's 999. James, did you want to talk about GoldenEye?
Yeah, so I actually started playing GoldenEye today and got through the first couple sections. And it's taken me a little... I mean, I haven't played it since E3, and I never played single player.
Single player was never demoed.
That's right, it was just shown, wasn't it?
Yeah, I saw someone play it at E3, but they never let the press play it.
Yeah, that's weird.
Play the single player until the game came out.
That is really
weird. Which
is
too bad. I think the single player is really good.
It took me a while to adjust to the controls, because, I mean, you can customize them, obviously. But it just took me a little bit of time to really get the pointer to do what I wanted it to do at first. So a lot of times I was, like, shooting, like, right past people's heads. Like, I was almost headshotting people. Instead, I was giving them, like, a bad haircut. And I was... So in the first couple stages, they kind of try to make you stealthy. And it just usually goes horribly wrong. And, like, you'll miss somebody and end up shooting a guy in the hand down the room, and he sets off the alarm, and you're fucked. But once I got the handle of it, I felt like I was able to competently, if not with just complete 100% accuracy, dispatch people relatively simply. It's not like when Red Steel came out, the original Red Steel, and I could just walk through with a handgun and headshot an entire room before anybody even shot at me. Which was awesome in its own way. You just go boom, 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 boom.
I
win.
Well, I definitely want to get back to GoldenEye and play a lot more of it. Other games have just been distracting me lately. But I got to say that after playing, you know, with the Wii Remote Nunchuck for maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours with that game, I switched to Classic Control and I haven't gone back. And I think at this point, I'm just done with trying to play first-person shooters with the pointer. And it's not that it doesn't work, and I'm not going to argue that it's not more accurate than other things, but, you know, keyboard and mouse is more accurate than playing with joysticks, and I still prefer joysticks because it's more comfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, just because something is the most accurate way to do it doesn't mean it's the best, and I just find it's really inconvenient and just physically taxing. You know, not that it wears you out, but you always have to think about how you're holding your arm and exactly yeah. where you're pointing. And the other thing is, and I think in most of the newer first-person shooters on Wii, if you play with the Wii remote, because it is so accurate, there's no auto-aim. There's no aim assist at all. Whereas if you throw it on Classic Controller, you just run around. It's not that it's super easy, but you don't have to think as much about aiming.
There is some level of auto-assist on when you...
Aim dead sights. Yeah, it's pretty helpful. I switched that off. I thought it was too helpful.
Yeah, I mean...
Greg's just like, this game isn't hard enough.
But the thing is, I would just spend my time just pressing aim down sights button all the time, you know, press aim down sights, then shoot, bang, you're dead. Ba-bang, ba-bang, ba-bang.
Yeah,
well, boring.
You know, it's interesting because that you say that because I was reading a preview actually of Killzone 3 with the move controls, and they said that it was too easy when you had the auto aim on.
It could be a similar sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, it goes back to the example I had with the original Red Steel, where I was like the Punisher. I mean, I was walking around with the handgun. People were coming out with the subway.
Which one? Are you talking the Thomas Jane Punisher or the Dolph Lundgren Punisher?
Oh, Dolph Lundgren, of course. How can you even ask?
I know. I've never really had an issue with the... I guess I've just found a way where I'm really comfortable with using the Wii Remote in that capacity, where I sort of just rest it on my leg.
Yeah.
And then just move my wrist very slightly. I'm not really thinking about it in terms of pointing. I'm just thinking of it in sort of moving my wrist, moving a cursor. You know, I'm not thinking like point at the top right of the screen. It's kind of very gestury subtle, and that works for me.
I recently came into possession of a very, very nice armchair, and it actually so overstuffed, I can just put my arm on the arm part of the chair. And
I thought you were about to say a Wii Zapper.
No. I will never own a Wii Zapper. Ever. But it just happens to be that it's angled perfectly at the TV, so I'm like, this is nice.
Yeah. For me, I'm sitting on the couch. The ends of the arms of the couch are way too high, and if I sit in the middle, I have to grab like a bunch of pillows to rest my shoulder up so that it's really, you know, at just the right angle. And it's just too much trouble, you know, and it doesn't make the game more fun for me. So
that's what's great about the fact that GoldenEye has all the options.
Yes, and Conduit 2 is going to have a bunch of different options too. You can play that with Classic as well.
They are the ultimate box checkers.
They are totally.
they ain't gonna miss.
I do feel though that I don't know. It's probably a little easy. I mean, I'm playing on not Agent, the one after that. Secret Agent, I think is what it is.
I think it goes like, was it like this operative and then agent and then something like, it's slightly different from the old.
Yeah, and then it's like operatives, like if you've never played video games before. Yeah, you're like, okay, great.
All right, but I mean, I guess you're enjoying it. We'll maybe get an update from you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see how it compares to Black Ops. That's what I'm really curious about.
That I can't answer, but I still think GoldenEye is great, and I really do want to play a lot more of it.
I enjoyed it.
And Greg doesn't even like first-person shooters.
No, but I think I've kind of settled in. Like, I had Killzone 2 about a year before GoldenEye, so maybe one a year is my pace. So
you don't think you're down for Killzone 3?
I might be when it's really cheap, which by that time it will probably have been like a year between GoldenEye and that. But I don't think, you know, if you put a another first-person shooter in my hands now, I don't think I'd enjoy it.
Yeah. Mm.
All right. Now, John, did you want to talk about Picross, or do you want to wait until...
Well, I'll give kind of like my first impressions of it. I've played a little bit through the...
It's a dog, John. That's the solution. It's a dog.
No, wait a minute. It's a boxer.
It's only a dog once.
It's a boxer, James. It's a type of dog.
James, one out of 350 puzzles is a dog.
Yep. Just keep guessing it's a dog, John. You'll get it right eventually.
No, but it's interesting because that game, like when I played it, I originally played it at PAX East last year. And I didn't really get what the deal was with it. You know, usually when I play a DS game at one of the Nintendo events, I'll sit down and play it for a while. But Picross 3D, I was like, I don't even want to sit here and learn this right now. Probably not the best environment to play the game. I'll admit that.
No, especially since that was the unit that was electrocuting people.
Yeah, see, that didn't happen to me, thankfully. But yeah, it's like I was just like
social experiment.
Yep.
it didn't stop Lauren. She just kept playing.
Yeah, it's like the Berkeley torture experiment. There's somebody behind the screen pushing a button when people.
But yeah, so I really wasn't interested. I mean, I never picked this. That's one of the reasons why I never picked it up, because I was like, if it was as great of a puzzle game as it's supposed to be, then it would have grabbed me right away. I felt it was kind of overrated. So, you know, much like Greg with Killzone 2, the price came down so low that my curiosity did defeat the price. So, yeah, I got it for like $10. I think it was on Amazon for $10.
Doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, the game gets so much love. Johnny is pretty much proposed to it at this point.
It's not overrated at all.
So I said, all right, fine. I will buy in and see what it's all about. So I've gone through the tutorial, and I must say, at first, it didn't grab me. I didn't really get how to solve the puzzles. Like, I understood it, but it's just, I think there's a certain point in it where you start to approach puzzles in the same way and kind of check the check boxes. Mm-hmm. And like, there's a couple of things, like when you learn how to approach each puzzle and the things that you should rule out right off the bat. And once you figure that out, once that clicks with you, it's very, very addictive.
You're building an algorithm. It doesn't sound very sexy, but that's what you're building an algorithm in your head, and you just execute.
That game totally teaches you to think like a computer.
Yeah,
it
does.
It makes doing so incredibly enjoyable.
Yep.
And that's what's magic about it, I think.
You'll start talking in binary. That's what's going to happen.
chipping away at it. It's very, very strangely satisfying. But yeah, so, you know, I've started playing that a little bit. Also, I picked up Rock Band 3. This has kind of like been my go back and grab the old games that I always wanted but never really got. And, you know, I've heard Rock Band 3 described as pretty much the best version of what Rock Band is, and I pretty much agree. I mean, I think they actually overhauled the UI, which was nice. The UI was looking kind of old.
Did you get the one with the keyboard?
No, I got it. It was on sale at Walmart for $30. So I don't have the keyboard.
Bomba. It's too bad.
I mean, I really do want the keyboard. It's one of those things where eventually if I see it for cheap, I'll pick it up. But yeah, the game for $30, because there's a lot of songs on there that it has, like a lot of 80s songs that my wife really likes.
That excuse.
Yeah.
Oh,
I like them too. They're good songs.
Oh, yeah.
They're good songs.
I don't like Heart. My wife likes Heart. It's not my fault.
I actually don't like Heart. My wife does.
No one likes
Heart. She's played way too much.
John, did you get on Xbox or?
Xbox, yeah.
Yeah. So you should check out the Rock Band Network sometime. There's some very interesting stuff on there. And unfortunately, there's so much content on Rock Band Network. I mean, this is where like people can sort of program their own songs and submit them to be sold.
Yeah.
And there's a whole revenue sharing model. And there's also just a lot of smaller artists that maybe wouldn't be approached by Harmonix to set up a licensing deal. But, you know, they or their fans or their marketing people or whatever can sort of do all the grunt work and, you know, get the song in there and map out the note charts for it, mm-hmm. and then submit that. And there are actually some really good professional bands that have songs on Rock Band Network, and unfortunately they're kind of hard to find because that store is so overflowing that it's really intimidating to go through it. But I wanted to tell you that, and you and the listeners, that if you really like playing guitar and you like songs with difficult but not wanky guitar parts, you know, if you're not into the whole like super fast heavy metal stuff, but you still like really interesting and challenging guitar parts, go to Rock Band Network and look up a band called Rodrigo y Gabriela. And they have two songs up right now on Rock Band Network, and they're both absolutely awesome. And the only parts on them are guitar and bass. and they are fantastic.
Didn't they just drop Rock Band Network support for Wii or something?
Yes, they did.
There's one more patch, and that's it.
Yep.
Yep. I don't know how many people buy songs on Wii, but apparently not enough to support. I didn't even know Rock Band Network games songs were being released on Wii. So.
There's a problem. Yeah.
All right, so that's going to wrap it up for new business. We're going to take one more quick break, and when we come back, we'll have a bit of your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, first up, of course, is our extensive and awesome coverage of the 3DS preview event that happened in New York and Amsterdam. Be sure to check out all our coverage of the unveiling of Nintendo 3DS, complete with plenty of video, really good video that's been referenced by many other websites.
Yeah, straight jacked by other websites.
Stolen. The word is stolen.
Degrees of plagiarism may vary. Mm-hmm. We've also got, of course, impressions of the hardware and the games, like Resident Evil Mercenaries, Kid Icarus Uprising, and Nintendogs plus Cats.
On the interview front, we have a Madden 3DS interview with Ryan Stradling, and we talk to the technical director of the series and ask him all about its return to Nintendo Portables, and he tells us why he thinks it's the, quote, best Madden NFL ever on a handheld, end quote.
It's a high watermark.
Yes. On the review front, we have James reviewing Sengoku Basara Samurai Heroes on the Wii in what he calls a visual assault on the senses. Verbatim quote.
I did call it that.
A visual assault on multiple senses.
How could you wage a visual assault on the sense of smell?
It, you know what? It engages a visual assault.
What they call
everything.
It again is it synesthesia? It gives you that?
It causes the brain to shut down. That's how it assaults all your senses.
You're not smelling jack shit if you're not conscious.
It's right.
Alright, so yes, James picks up his sword and tells us whether or not carving through samurais ever gets old. Check out his review to find out if it does or not.
I am the master of superpowered samurai genocide.
Next review is from Neil. He looks at Worms Battle Islands for Wii. Is this the Worms game to own? Neil takes a look at this newest entry in the long-running franchise and lets us know if it's worth your while. Next in reviews, we have Andy looking at WWE SmackDown vs. Raw 2011. Will wrestling fans get thrown to the mat with this new title in the series? Will they hold the championship belt? Andy's review hops in the ring and lets you know.
Also in reviews, we have Carly's review of Mario vs. Donkey Kong Mini Land Mayhem for the DS, which is the newest and yet another Mario vs. Donkey Kong game. Andy has a review of Lost in Shadow for Wii, a unique platformer he finds enjoyable, but you have to ask if it wears out its welcome.
Okay, well, be sure to check out all this original content and much more over at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back! It's time for listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We've been getting some really cool emails lately, and we're going to try to knock a few out here. So I believe Greg has the first one.
Yes, Adolf Vega writes, do you guys think Nintendo is smart enough to have Avatar 3D as exclusive to the 3DS? Currently, the Avatar Blu-ray and DVD do not have the 3D version, so having the exclusive 3D version as a pack-in cartridge would be brilliant for 3DS. Avatar is a worldwide success, and the 3D is fantastic, so it seems like a no-brainer. What do you guys think?
There's got to be a lot of money eventually for the movie studio and for James Cameron in 3D versions, home versions of Avatar.
Mm-hmm. There's a curious case actually over here with the biggest satellite television company, Sky. They have a fairly narrow 3D service, mostly sporting events. But for some reason, they were able to show Avatar in 3D over the Christmas period, like during the week between Christmas and New Year's, but not since. So it's a curious arrangement there. It seems like, yeah, they are restricting its availability. Is there some sort of deal with Panasonic or something I heard about? I haven't even seen Avatar. Don't ask me what I know about it.
So yeah. In terms of Panasonic, and it's important we discuss them in particular, because them and even to a greater extent Samsung are the two huge engines that drive innovation in the TV business. Samsung invests ungodly amounts of money that would make Sony sweat, the amount of money they invest. And as a result, you can ask me a million times, I'm going to tell you, if you want the best TV, you're probably going to wind up with a Samsung.
Yep. I've had a Samsung for years.
Oh, it's because they're willing to spend the money. And Panasonic, it doesn't spend as much money, but they're nearby. And both of them have spent much more money trying to develop a 3D solution than a lot of their counterparts. So it wouldn't surprise me if one of them does arrange some sort of deal.
Well, I think that Avatar could come to 3DS eventually, but I thought they might talk about it last Wednesday, and they didn't, but we still don't know much about the video-type services for 3DS.
Yeah, the delivery mechanisms and that sort of thing.
Right.
I mean, there was a certain amount of this discussed at the European event, again, from what I saw of it.
In terms of, like, broadcasting type?
Yeah, they were talking about short-form content. Exclusively.
Right.
This would be the kind of stuff that would be Spot Pass. You know, I guess maybe you opt in to a service where you download these little videos, like they mentioned 3D sports highlights from Sky, for instance, again.
Yeah, and then there's an Aardman series called Shaun the Sheep.
Yeah, Aardman animation shorts and you know, Eurosport as well. So, you know, little digest kind of videos, sports highlights, 3D, this, that. But all of that is very much far away from feature film, especially something bloated as Avatar surely is.
Yes.
I mean, they've made some aspirational noises. I think there were interviews after the events that occurred on Wednesday where they said, you know, oh, well, when we show it to people from the movie industry, there's a lot of interest there, this, that, and the other, but there's nothing solid about, you know, that's the key distribution mechanism. John mentioned, you know, Netflix and his predictions, you know, we can get streaming. That's all an open question. Until you get that resolved, I don't know that we're going to get anything like Avatar or any other 3D movies until we know what's going to be the most viable delivery mechanism.
Right.
The other issue with delivery mechanisms, and we've discussed it, is that, just like Greg was saying, Avatar is a big... I mean, I think it's like 3 hours runtime.
No.
I don't know. There is a longer version.
There, yeah, that's true. They did they did release it back into theaters, but I think it was only like 5 minutes of extra footage.
Oh. Well, it's still... I mean, you're going to need consistent connection. You're not going to be able to download that shit.
Or they could sell it on a card, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know if it would fit.
We don't know.
Are we dredging up the bad memories of UMD where we get into that?
No, I was thinking about GBA video.
Yeah, that's
where we're going. Jesco joint.
Yeah, square pants stuff on, you know,
yes.
GBA cartridges.
Pokemon.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff, it's not obvious how they're going to do it.
No.
I'm sure, you know, it'd be something that, you know, they would love to maybe associate 3DS with the success of Avatar while it's still relatively fresh, but doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Well, and I think the other thing is that it's not clear how much work would be involved in setting up a 3D movie, you know, in formatting it so that it works with the 3DS technology, because 3DS, the way it displays 3D is quite different from the way a 3D TV displays it, which is quite different from the way a 3D theater screen projects
right.
it. It could be a pretty involved process potentially especially for a 2.5 hour movie to get it ready for that type of screen. And so that could be part of it as well. You know, it's not like you can just drag it in a folder and make it work exactly the way you want. And especially someone like Cameron, he's going to want to make sure that it looks as good as it possibly can on that screen. So he's going to want it to be optimized for the system.
Right. And like, even now, Avatar is the standard by which all 3D movies are judged, and they all fail.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and I think this will absolutely happen eventually. I don't think it'll be exclusive to 3DS, but I think it will come to 3DS, because look at it this way. By the end of this year, there will be several million 3DSs sold around the world. And you can't really say that for 3D TVs by the end of this year.
It will be unique in that regard.
It's just going to have such a market penetration, and it's going to grow so much faster than any other 3D technology. I mean, unless the iPad 2 has a 3D screen, which I don't think it will, then nothing can compete with 3DS for sheer number of units. So if you want your 3D movie to be seen in 3D... there's no better device to put it on than 3DS, even though it's a little bitty screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that kind of thing will happen, but in terms of the form and the timing, I guess it's not happening anytime soon. Let's put it that way. All right, let's move on. The next question is from Lolmanade from Illinois, who writes,
"Wow,
first time emailing you. Wanted to say first that I was told by a coworker to listen to your show 6 months ago and am grateful he did. I find your discussion to be thoughtful, honest, and humorous, which makes for a very entertaining podcast. Also wanted to thank Greg for the superb editing. Whenever I listen to another podcast, I realize how much I take for granted podcast chapters, pictures, and a detailed description of what is discussed. Anyway, I've come to find that when I was younger, I loved some games that I now realize are actually quite terrible. My unconditional love for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles on NES is a good example of this. The game is difficult for all the wrong reasons, such as floods of enemies that respawn every time you scroll across the level, 3 or 4 characters that are useless,
perfect,
unintentional design errors, and that god-awful underwater stage.
Yes.
Yet, I love playing the game because of a mix of nostalgia and masochism,
perfect,
as well as seeing if I can finally beat the Technodrome. Spoiler alert, I can't. My question, do you guys have a fondness for or still play games from your childhood that you know are terrible or have flaws in them that you wouldn't accept in a modern game?
Tecmo Super Bowl.
Oh, God. The flaw in that is that there's a win button.
Yeah. there are so many things that you can do in that game. Lunging forward with your nose tackle that will,
yes,
cause the QB to fumble every time.
Yes,
to the point,
Will,
where you have to the point where you have to outlaw it if you're playing people.
Yeah. I wanted to know that even stuff like, I remember Madden 92, pretty much we had to outlaw attempting to block punts. It was too easy.
Oh yeah. I mean that was like the old NCAA football game I talked about here, where it was
the play
action fade that went for a touchdown, regardless of where you were on the field, 100% of the time.
Yeah.
The problem is that game is from the 21st century.
And that game is only 6 years old.
Anything non-sports?
I see, it's weird because I wouldn't say there's a number of these games that falls into these categories that I love or that I even enjoyed, but I do remember playing them quite a lot.
Yeah.
That's the weird thing. Like, you know, even, I guess it was just didn't have many games, but mm-hmm. had plenty of free time. So, you know, you just ended up playing stuff even if you didn't like it that much.
Mylon Secret Castle would be one.
Oh, that game is terrible.
Okay.
No, that's it. You just fucking kicked off them. You just assassinated Archduke Ferdinand. It's over.
Yes, the powder keg has been lit.
It's a game that
the House of Cards falls.
Look, if you can't beat the game without a copy of Nintendo Power, it's extortion.
It is, man.
It is extortion.
Yeah, I was going to mention Mylon Secret Castle, although I don't think it's a bad game, but it's certainly a game that is extraordinarily difficult to play now.
It's a Hudson NES game. It's not exactly the height of the genre or the medium, you know?
Of any genre.
Yeah.
No, but I do still like it. I can totally still play Mylon Secret Castle, and I have. But I go back now, and I think this is so obtuse. I mean, my patience for stuff like that when I was a kid was so much higher. The other game, and it's not something I would ever play again, but certainly at the time, I thought it was awesome, and I played a shitload of it, is Cruisin' USA for
N64. Oh, no.
You were a bit old to be playing that thinking it was awesome, weren't you?
Well, no, I was like 14 when that game came out.
Yeah, it's just too old.
And, you know, it was a launch title for N64. So back then, all I had, actually, I got that for Christmas. So I had Mario for the first couple of months, and then for Christmas, I think I got Killer Instinct Gold and Cruisin' USA, neither of which are in genres.
Christmas 96, I had Pilot Wings of Wave Race, so I'll take my Christmas over yours.
Yeah, see, I rented those, but I didn't own them. I don't know why I wanted those other two, because I'm not into fighting games, and I'm not really into racing games.
And you did not pick highlights of the genre either.
No, I still think Killer Instinct Gold is pretty good, but it's just like, how much am I going to get to play that, you know?
Yeah.
My sister didn't want to play it with me, so that's out. And most of my friends were, you know, it's a very technical fighting game. It's a very technical combo system it's hard for people to learn. Cruisin' USA, it was easy to get people to play it because they recognized it from the arcade, but holy shit, that game is terrible. I mean, just I can't even stand to watch videos of it now. It's so bad.
Yeah, I can't think of one like that. I mean, I can remember playing quite a lot of Hogan's Alley, which is terrible. But I can also remember thinking, this is terrible as a 6-year-old. Well, you know?
Like Kung Fu. Kung Fu's terrible.
Kung Fu is another one.
Oh, Kung Fu. I always knew Kung Fu was bad.
I can remember going around on that again to get more hearts at the end. Yeah. And yet also thinking, this is rubbish. And that is not really something I can reconcile in my mind.
Yeah, usually kids shouldn't recognize how terrible a game is, especially an NES game where they're kind of like, this is what we get, you know? The standard shouldn't really be ironed in quite yet.
Well, my game to fit that mold is Kid Icarus. I always knew that was bad. And was all my friends were into it. And I was
Ferdinand's
like,
down again.
Wait a minute. You've said it. You've started it now.
How many princeps are in here?
Mylan's Secret Castle is way better than Kid Icarus.
But at least you don't need Nintendo power to beat it.
So this way we need the old school Monday Night Football intro of the two sprites banging into each other and exploding in a shower of pixels. See, nowadays, if the helmet's actually classed, it'd be a 15-yard penalty and $100,000 fine.
That's right. Yep.
As I've discussed on the show in the past, my parents hated me. So my collection of NES games.
And so you hate everyone else back.
They hated you because they kept buying you video games.
They kept buying me video games that are on all time worst NES game lists. I mean,
you don't think it could have been bad luck?
There's like a list. There's like a list of 30 games. I went there one time. I had like 10 of them. I was like, what the fuck?
Were you like Hyde Lied? Did you have that one?
I had both of the Addams Family games, which are historically bad.
Oh, Fester's Quest is actually pretty good.
No, the Addams Family games.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know anything about that. Fester's Quest is pretty good,
though. Fester's Quest is kind of fucked, though, because you can get stuck in these places where that respawning enemy just keeps spawning, and you're trapped in a corner. And
it's brutally difficult, but it's well-designed overall. It's a pretty good game.
Did you get that Action 52 of 1 or whatever
it is? I never had that one, thank God.
Cheater, man.
but one of the games they got me is called Wampum, which isn't a bad game.
I've heard of this.
Sounds entirely politically correct as well.
But it's horribly racist. I mean, it just is. It's so bad. And, like, I'm looking at the box art right now going, holy crap.
Isn't there that Huck Finn game or something?
Yes.
The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Square.
Yeah, it's so racist they couldn't release it in the 80s.
That's right.
It's like, we can't do anything with this game to make it not completely racist.
James' parents hated him so much they imported Takeshi's Castle for him. Here, son, do some karaoke in Japanese.
I had the Ninja Turtle game from The Question. Good. Perfect.
Yeah, everybody played that game, though, and we all knew it sucked.
Yeah, I was lucky. I loved the Turtles back then, but for some reason didn't get that game. I count myself lucky because I probably would have gone to the bitter end.
I had the I had the Muppet Adventure, which is awful.
Oh, God.
I had X-Men, which is also awful.
Oh, X-Men is one of the worst NES games I've ever seen.
And my
played.
Parents got that for me. You're welcome.
I rented that once. I was like, what the fuck does this have to do with X-Men?
I don't know. I had Gilligan's Island. Fuck.
Holy shit. Really?
How random is that?
Really?
Who buys that?
I don't know. It's so bad, though.
Our 5-year-old will love this Gilligan's Island game.
Gilligan's Island. Oh, my God. Did your parents even know you? Good Lord.
To be clear, you didn't actually enjoy any of these at the time, did you?
No.
I can see why you like all the games you do now, James, just because it's like a complete reaction.
I have the urge to see James dressed up as Gilligan.
Yeah, that's it.
I want to be Bob Denver today.
All right, so I just pulled up the Sean Baby feature. 3 games I owned are on this list. Oh, wow. Where's Waldo? 4.
You had Where's Waldo?
I also rented Total Recall at some point, and that's...
Oh, yeah, Andy was on talking about Total Recall's unwanted Christmas gift last year.
It's fucking unplayable! So in this list of 20 games, I have owned or played 4 of them.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm sorry.
All right, so are we out of games that we loved as a child and now we realize are bad?
Well, I didn't love any of those games, but
yeah, I'm sure you didn't.
It's harrowing, but I don't think you answered the question.
No, Wampum is my example because it's a good Mega Man clone, but I could never play that game now. I would get, like, white man guilt. The game I still love, even though it's got a serious, serious flaw, is Ogre Battle 64, which is just slow. The game speed's too slow, and you can speed it up, but it's still too slow.
More on that later.
Yeah. It's still awesome, though.
Okay.
But I have to ignore that particular flaw.
All right. So thanks for the letter, Lulmanade. Just wanted to say that again.
Lulmanade.
James, you've got the next letter.
Slade writes, I cannot recall any of you doing much talk about the Mass Effect series. Have any of you played these games? Shut up,
Define
John.
Play.
John, you're supposed to only get to the question
bought,
first.
Unwrapped? Yes.
Oh, you did unwrap them. Good. So it's not like the sandwich.
I have recently gotten into it. In 3 weeks, I have beaten part one twice, with 30 plus hours in each game, and I'm now 8 hours into part two. I have now named the series my number one series, at least based on story, out of 20 plus years of my gaming life. I would love to hear your thoughts on this series. Please! I have become overly addicted to this game. P.S. The show is effing awesome, by the way. So, I actually did a really disturbing level of devotion to this game in an episode where I'm like, I've missed sleep because of this game.
Me too, really.
I was up at like 3:30 in the morning and I had work the next day. I'm like, 5 more minutes.
Yeah, well, I thought Mass Effect 1 was pretty good, and I liked it more than I thought I would. And then that was really my first Western RPG. And I think the reason that I was able to get over my antipathy towards that genre is that I really like the sci-fi setting, and the story was... But those two games combined, I think, have one of the best stories ever in any video game. Not much else even comes close, in my opinion. And in Mass Effect 2, the gameplay is so much better that it was just alchemical for me. I mean, I was in love with that game immediately. And I've actually been fighting off the urge to play through it again as, like, evil Lady Shepard, because I have got too many other games I want to play, but I would really love to play through that entire game again.
Yeah, I've thought about going through that game and just being complete asshole, because, I mean...
I'm amazed you didn't do that.
I played...
That's pretty much your default mode, James.
I usually feel really bad when I do mean things in games or I have choices like that. So I don't tend to. There have been a few games like I know when I was playing Fallout, somebody's save, I went through and just started assassinating the entire village. So when he came back, it's like, why is everybody dead?
Oops.
But the trigger just kept firing over and over in every building. But see, I really liked 1 because I liked the ability to do more of the customization stuff.
I just thought a lot of it was useless. A lot of the loot was useless. You know?
Well, yeah, but a lot of times I was just going, yeah, I don't need this. I just left it there. And then I would just keep walking. And I kind of like the ability to just collect the stuff off the bodies. But 2 was much more action-oriented. So in a way, it's more rewarding, but you don't get to have quite the same level of pre-battle decisions. A lot of times, you just hop from place to place to place and just go on firefights. I mean, to be clear to how thoroughly I played this game, I mapped every planet in the system.
Me too.
And that takes forever.
Now, John, we know that you've had a sort of a touch-and-go approach to Mass Effect.
Touch the box and then get the hell out of the room.
It's a lot of going, not really too much touching. Mass Effect is actually...
No, Mass Effect. I can't stress that enough. Mass Effect. Mass Effect. Mass Effect.
Mass Effect. That's the legendary game where I sunk, I think, an hour and a half into it, put it back on the shelf where it sat for 2 years, 2 years until I picked it up again. And then I put maybe another half hour into it, and it resides there waiting for me. It looks at me sometimes.
John's going to finish this game in like 3074.
This is my life's work. That and Chrono Trigger.
When Charlton Heston is pounding his fists on the ground going, you blew it up, you bastards, you blew it. There's John playing Mass Effect next to the Statue of Liberty.
It's too bad. I mean, John, I'm sure you would love it. And you've already paid for it, so at some point.
It's never stopped me before.
It's all gravy from here, John.
Don't ever underestimate the way I can put stuff on the shelf and never play it. Never, ever, ever underestimate it.
Well, as we know, Greg doesn't have an Xbox 360, but Mass Effect 2 just came out on PS3, so what's your stance on this, Greg?
Now, let me just say before Greg says his piece, the sad thing is, I read a review that said, hey, the PS3 version of Mass Effect 2 is the best version out there. And for a second there, I was like... Oh, so tempting to purchase it.
Oh, God, John. That is the point where you just need to be put down, John. If you do that, if you do that, it's time to take old Yeller out back.
Well,
See, what I'm curious about regarding the PS3's version of Mass Effect 2 is they're not getting Mass Effect 1.
No, but there's some sort of like vaguely interactive comic book presentation of the major decision points of 1 that you go through as a prologue to 2. So you have some sort of, you know, you bring over a certain amount of decisions into 2, but it's not the full range. It doesn't capture everything. That's not a barrier to me. The fact that 2 sounds more action oriented is more my kind of thing. I'm not going to go rush out and buy it. I've not paid very much for any of my PS3 games, and if I pick this up, it'll probably be down the road where it's a wee bit cheaper, because at the minute it's a vast disparity. You know, if you wanted to pick it up on 360 now, it'd be a tenner. If you want to pick it up on PS3, it's closer to 40. So I will wait until that disparity is lessened, but I wouldn't mind giving it a go.
I bet you'll like it a lot, Greg. It's maybe my favorite game of 2010, actually. I mean, over every platform, I'm not sure that I enjoyed or was addicted to anything on quite the same level as Mass Effect 2 last year. So
yep.
I'm a huge fan, and I'm a little anxious about how the third one's going to shape up this fall, but I almost kind of hope it gets delayed, because I feel like for how ambitious that series is and how the games seem like they get actually more complex and more difficult to make as they go on, I'd kind of like to see them take as much time as they need to with it, you know, but I am very thrilled to play more Mass Effect, that's for sure.
See, I would say that Slade might want to try the Dragon Age games. Personally, they didn't quite do it for me like Mass Effect did.
Yeah, they're not appealing to me at all.
They're much more Western RPG oriented. It's kind of a setting thing too. That's probably what they were going for.
Yeah, I'm so sick of Lord of the Rings and all that. I mean,
storytelling wise, they do a good job, but I don't know. Just for me, it wasn't quite as addictive, which is good, because I didn't have to stay up till 3:30 in the morning playing through those games.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for listener mail. Thanks, everyone, for writing in. We do have even more coming up soon. And, of course, we're happy to get new emails from everyone. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Now, we have an update on the retroactive feature. The poll, you know, it only ran for about a week, and it's over now. So we have a result, and the next game that we're playing for retroactive, number 16, is Ogre Battle 64.
Woo!
Person of lordly caliber.
Ah, yes.
James is thrilled because it means he doesn't have to do any work for this feature.
Look, I've only memorized all the dialogue choices in most of the chaos frames.
Oh, God. Actually, James, I wanted to ask, both for our benefit as well as anyone listening to this who would like to play along, the game is only $10 on Virtual Console. It's very accessible. Well, I should say it's very obtainable. I don't know how accessible it is, but
it's much more attainable and much less expensive than when I got it. Yes.
Yes. But James, can you give us any quick advice in terms of, you know, anything that would make the game easier outside of a cheat?
Outside of the cheat, well, there is a huge one if you really get stuck, and you can find it online. But the party structure, because the game basically you build parties, not individual units, versus the Final Fantasy Tactics games where you're sending out individual units. So you need to think about parties like equipment for one person. So you need to try to make sure that all the pieces complement each other. So if you have two heavy hitters in the front, the party leader in the middle, so they have a certain amount of safety, so in the middle row, behind someone, because if the party leader gets knocked out, you're fucked.
Okay.
And a healer or two in the back, you'll be in good shape.
Okay. So Ogre Battle 64, it's out there. Go get it. Play along with us. We'll wait a couple of weeks so that we have time to get into it a little bit. It is a long and very deep and
so damn long.
Complex game. We'll say sophisticated game. But it is also very interesting. I haven't played it in many years, so I'm somewhat excited to get back into it and give it another shot.
The only other piece of advice I have is take your time before going into battle to make sure everything's perfect. I mean, making sure you're set up right makes a huge freaking difference.
Well, that's pretty much your primary influence over the outcome.
Yeah.
Because once the battle starts, you kind of watch it happen, right?
Well, I mean, you direct where they go, but it's very similar to, like, if you're really the commander of an armed forces, you don't get to control them individually. Mm-hmm. You make sure everybody's set up, and you're like, all right, there's your objective. Get there.
Okay, so we will be playing Ogre Battle 64. I hope you will be as well. There'll be a forum thread at NintendoWorldReport.com, and you can jump in there and leave your comments, and we'll be discussing the game, and then we'll pull some of those comments out for when we talk about it on the show. Finally, we have a very exciting announcement to make. We just found out a couple of days ago that RFN is returning to PAX East for another live panel experience.
No.
And we're very, very, very happy about this. I'm thrilled, actually, to be going back to Boston again and to do this crazy show with our fans present right there in person. And, of course, to see a lot of my friends. And, you know, we'll probably get to play 3DS at PAX East.
We should, yeah. Unless Nintendo is incredibly stupid.
It's going to be about 2 weeks before the system launches in the U.S., so... it's going to be an exciting time to be there, to be talking about Nintendo, and, you know, that's what we do, usually. So, I'm thrilled about it. I hope you will come, if it's at all possible. I really hope you'll be able to attend. We'd love to meet you, and talk to you, and get your questions in person, and interact with you. So, that's going down March 12th. Which is Saturday. It's the second day out of three for PAX East, and our panel is at 10:30 a.m. So hopefully, actually, I'm almost certain that we will not be preempted by the keynote this year.
It yeah. would be a very late keynote.
We might actually have a respectably sized audience, which is pretty cool.
So come, be loud, wear a green man suit.
Yeah,
good to go.
Hang around afterwards, because, you know, it just seemed like everybody kind of cleared out right afterwards.
Well, we were being kicked out, too.
Yeah, they keep us on a pretty tight schedule, because they do have other panels that they have to get in there. But we would love to hang out afterward, and we might even be, you know, trying to set up some kind of meetup somewhere outside the convention where we can go and have some drinks and, you know, do karaoke or whatever.
Yeah.
Because John and I need, you know, we need to do some regulate. And
oh, absolutely. God, no, I don't.
Anyway, yes, we are very, very happy to be returning to Boston for PAX East, and we hope you will be as well. So let us know if you plan on coming, and let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about at the live panel, because we're going to be starting to plan that very soon, and we hope to make it bigger and better than last year. And, of course, thanks to the people at PAX East, especially Jeff Callis, who I'm sure had some influence over this, for letting us come back and do this again. We're really happy about it. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Later.
Bye.
Bye, bye, Brady.
Man, I wish I could have played some Rock Band when I was staying with you. I really wanted to. I saw you have the Ion drum kit.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
That thing's awesome.
And I'm not good at drums, but I would love to sit down and try that thing out. But
yeah,
it was
pretty cool.
We had very little time to play games, unfortunately, and we kind of had to pick and choose. So
yeah.
We picked Killzone 2, I guess.
Yeah, that's it.
I think it was just John's way of inviting you to eat his bullets.
Eat my bullets. It was said a couple of times, I'm not going to lie.
Oh, that's awful. That's terrible.
Well, John, maybe I'll get another chance to play Rock Band with you and even a few other friends of ours. But more on that later.
Yes.
You're in the Mafia?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a shock. Are you moving up? They just made a bunch of busts over there.
Yeah. Also in reviews, we have Carly's review of Mario vs. Donkey Kong Mini Land Mayhem for the DS, which is the newest and yet another Mario vs. Donkey Kong game. See if this entry into the puzzle series lives up to the franchise's high pedigree. I got this next line. I'm like, fuck you, John. No.
Wind up your Mario and give it a read. If you don't read it, I will, James.
It's horrible.
I need more wine.
Andy has a review of Lost in Shadow for Wii, a unique platformer he finds enjoyable, but you have to ask if it wears out its welcome.
His review gives you the scoop.
It's implicit.
Jesus. You are really testing me this time, aren't you?
Just stick to the script and we'll be fine, guys. Trust me.
No, we won't be, because then you'll put in like a dick joke.
I have never put a dick joke in now play.
You just did. You did like four sections ago.